Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The hard rebuilding and recovery lie ahead after Hurricane Harvey. Lives upended, billions of dollars headed to Texas. And now we've got Irma bearing down from the Atlantic, warnings of more destruction. Do we need to organize differently to deal with the challenges of this century? This hour on Point, Harvey, Irma, fires in the West, and the call for a Green New Deal. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's the right mix now of neighbor helping neighbor and big safety net? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lots of praise and real kind of deep satisfaction to see all the neighbor helping neighbor that came out in Houston and people coming in from all over Texas and well beyond. On Sunday, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner praised the resilience of Houston residents as they took the recovery of Harvey day by day.
This is a can-do city. This is a can-do city. We're not going to, you know, engage in a pity party. We're going to take care of each other. Neighbors are taking care of each other. Good Samaritans. Businesses are responding. Community, neighborhood people are responding. But we are getting back on our feet, and we are open for business.
Fair enough and good enough, but this is about more than just plucking your neighbor off the back deck. It's going to take a lot of heavy investment to get this region back on its feet. On Sunday, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott told Fox News that his state will likely require far more than the federal aid of the initial nearly $8 billion proposed by Congress.
Now, I think Congress understands this is a down payment on something that will cost far more. Understanding again, this is far larger than Hurricane Sandy, that I think was around $40 to $50 billion. And so we have a long road to hoe if we're going to rebuild the fourth largest city in the United States, as well as the entire geographic region.
$40 to $50 billion, and even that maybe just a down payment. The governor of Texas went on.
The geographic area and the population affected by this horrific hurricane and flooding, not just in Houston, but also in the Belmont area, is far larger than the population and geographic area of Katrina. Katrina cost, if I recall, more than $120 billion. When you look at the number of homes and businesses affected by this, I think this will cost well over $120 billion, probably $150 to $180 billion.
Okay, $180 billion. We're talking serious money now. And here we've got another hurricane bearing down. With us today from Houston is Diana Hunt, Metro Editor for the Houston Chronicle. They've been in the thick of this for days and days now. Diana Hunt, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Where are you in the recovery? We've seen streets that were flooded a week ago that look dry now, but inside those homes and businesses, there's a lot of damage.
There's a lot of damage all across the city and people in the county, and people are still trying to assess the damage. The traffic, for example, everyone came back to work after the Labor Day holiday, astounded by the gridlock in traffic. There's still so many roads closed, so many commuter roads closed, that the traffic has intensified on those roads that are passable. So even though it looks better and it's a lot cleaner in some areas, there's still a lot of residual damage. The government agencies are only just now beginning to assess what damages they have. The criminal courthouse downtown, the main center for our criminal justice system, is not habitable. They've been cleaning it out. They're moving into temporary offices. We're supposed to hear this morning what they're going to do with the court system, where they're going to operate. All of those things this ripple effect just goes throughout the whole area.
Diana, what are the first challenges when it comes to recovery, and what are the grand scale challenges that are going to require the many billions the Texas governor is talking about there, maybe $180 billion?
Well, the first challenge is to find people places to live. There's already a shortage of affordable housing in the Houston area, and we've already been dealing with that. We have a long list of people waiting for Section 8 housing, waiting for housing assistance. This is going to triple, quadruple that number, I'm certain. We still have people in shelters. They're trying to get them into places to live, but there aren't very many places. We've had people who were suggested perhaps they just go to San Antonio and find a place to live, and we've had vouchers for people down in Galveston, which is a 45-minute hour commute. If you work here, it's not a very convenient place to live generally. So that's the short term, is to find people places to live where they can start to rebuild their lives. The long term is huge. We have areas, neighborhoods that have flooded repeatedly in the last 3 years, again and again and again. Do you rebuild those areas? Do you buy those people out? That's something that we've done in Texas a couple of times in the past decades. It's not a very common. It's not a very popular thing on anybody's part. But there are questions now about whether some of these areas should even be rebuilt.
Diana, we've been so impressed with the work you've done at the Houston Chronicle in the midst of this storm. But there's a context for it as well in Texas. I mean, Texas has been a state that, I know Houston is a Democratic leaning in party terms, but Texas overall has been sort of allergic to the idea of big government. Ted Cruz was very critical when it came time for Hurricane Sandy recovery money some years ago. What about now when Texas needs the money? How do Texans think about the big helping hand from Washington?
I think that the general understanding in at least certainly in this area of Texas and in the large cities is that no one area can possibly handle the devastation together. And it doesn't just mean Houston gets the benefit of this. We have oil refineries in this area that are the supply of oil and gas is being controlled by the fact that these some of these plants have been shut down. So helping Houston helps a lot of other people. And I think that they're starting to realize that. I think there's been very little backlash here for the politicians who are now saying, yeah, we want the federal help. I think it's easier to understand when it's your backyard.
Do people feel a little bit, embarrassed that they were tough on Sandy, but when it's Harvey in their backyard, it's bring it on?
You know, I guess you'd have to ask them that question. I think in the Houston area, this is a very blue Democratic area. I don't think there's been a lot of pushback in this area about funding other relief efforts. We've had a history with hurricanes. It's an area that's going to be targeted over the decades. And I think the people who've been here for a while understand that when something like this happens, we all have to pitch in.
Right.
I think we know with Katrina next door in Louisiana, we understand that happens.
The view there from the Houston Chronicle, Diana Hunt is Metro editor there. You all have done a remarkable job of covering this storm, and we thank you for that. And thank you for joining us today, Diana. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Housing, 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 said Houston's mayor on Face the Nation on Sunday. Immediate needs, big needs in Houston after Harvey.
Housing, housing, housing assistance. We need rapid repair housing because many, many people have elected to stay in their homes. They're now dry, but they need to be repaired. In some cases, they may need to be rebuilt. And this is especially important for our seniors, low-income communities, but really people all over the city. So housing, 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 rapid repair housing. And I asked him to expand the rapid repair housing program from 15,000 up to 35,000. The second thing, debris removal.
Debris removal, and we've all seen the images of that. FEMA has been active on the ground there. FEMA head Brock Long was also on Face the Nation on Sunday, and he said Texans and others just can't just depend on FEMA when it comes to natural disaster response. Here he was.
What we need are for elected officials at all levels of government to hit the reset button, sit down, evaluate where their programs are with their state emergency management directors as well as their local emergency management directors, and make sure that they have everything they need to increase their levels of self-sufficiency. This is a partnership, but this event is one that we're all going to have to sit down and hit the reset button on and figure out how we collectively improve.
Hit the reset button, and that, as the country looks, not just at Harvey, but now we've got Irma there. We've got, what is the number, 80 wildfires in the West, including the biggest in terms of area, one ever in Los Angeles right now. People are responding in all kinds of ways, some looking at systemically, and wondering, are we properly organized for the century ahead? Rebecca Elliott joins us right now from London, the London School of Economics, professor there. She wrote a piece recently in the New York Times, op-ed piece, said, in Hurricane Harvey's wake, we need a Green New Deal. Her upcoming book is Underwater Floods and the Governance of Climate Change Risk in the United States. Rebecca Elliott, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You say we need a Green New Deal in the face of challenges like this. What is it and why?
Well, the Green New Deal is this idea that in the face of an immense challenge like climate change, what we really need is a much more kind of organized and collective response to what this challenge portends. The first impulse in the wake of a disaster like Harvey is a largely humanitarian one, which is laudable. It's precisely the types of things that we've been seeing in the news of Houstonians helping Houstonians and people coming to the aid of their neighbors and strangers. And what I'm suggesting in the piece that I wrote for the New York Times is that we can take that compassionate impulse and we can turn it into a more enduring sort of compassion and care by building a more supportive society that is also organized to help us fight this immense challenge that we have in front of us.
Is it a more, what kind of society is that again?
A more supportive society.
More supportive. So,
okay. So as we just heard, you know, Houston already has a shortage of affordable housing. So in a lot of respects, when disasters like these hit, we're less prepared than ever before to kind of pick up the pieces after them. You know, the way that a disaster hits a city doesn't discriminate between rich and poor, but it deepens some of the inequities and insecurities that have always existed in those cities. And so part of a response to climate change is part of addressing some of these gaps in our social safety net.
You look back at how the nation moved away from the Great Society vision in the 80s, in the 90s, and away from social programs. You're saying climate change may push us, encourage us to look back to those, may require that we look back to those?
I think it will, or it should. You know, climate change is something that kind of transforms the economic conditions that we face, and these disasters, if we're to expect more of them, fundamentally alter the trajectories of people's lives when they hit. I mean, when a house goes down, it really means starting over for a family. It means the loss of, in many cases, the most important asset that a family will ever own. And picking up the pieces, I think, is something that we should all be interested in finding new and better ways of doing.
It can mean that for a family, it can mean it for an entire region. Texas, the Gulf Coast right now, who knows what comes with Florida. Rebecca Elliott says it's time for a Green New Deal. We'll explore what that might mean. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. With Harvey behind us, Irma ahead, fires all over the West, we are talking about how to organize for the years ahead and talk of a Green New Deal. Congress moving today on paying for the recovery of the Gulf Coast. We're hearing numbers out of the Texas governor like $150 billion, $180 billion. The pain and damage goes deep into individual lives and right across entire regions. Rebecca Elliott is with us, professor of sociology at the London School of Economics. She's raised a flag. It's been raised before. Tom Friedman raised it back 2007 or so. Jill Stein in her Green Party campaign. Others along the way talk of a Green New Deal, of thinking about how we're organized for a century that's got plenty of environmental challenges. As of last night, about 80 wildfires were raging across 9 western states, including the largest ever in Los Angeles. At one point, more than 1,000 firefighters battling that blaze. Here's Marcy Gonzalez with ABC News.
Firefighters working through the night, a state of emergency in California as dozens of wildfires burn, including the largest blaze ever recorded in the city of Los Angeles.
This is the biggest fire in 50 years, one of the biggest fires in our entire history.
Scorching more than 7,000 acres of the iconic hills surrounding the country's second largest city. A wall of smoke towering above LA neighborhoods, homes destroyed.
Okay, there's the fire. Here's the flood or coming flood. Puerto Rico, right in the face of it now. Florida, in the days ahead, we'll see. Here's Florida Governor Rick Scott declaring a state of emergency for his entire state earlier this week, said during a press conference last night, Hurricane Irma poses a significant threat.
Hurricane Irma is a dangerous and life-threatening Category 5 storm with winds of up to 185 miles per hour. 185 miles per hour. Just think about that. The storm is massive, and the storm surge that is predicted will go for miles and miles.
There's the Florida Governor Rick Scott. I mean, this is a new reality. So what's a level-headed, sensible way of organizing for it? How should we respond as individuals, collectively, to the threats of climate change, an era of heightened challenges? Is Houston the new model? People, individuals with their smartphones and motorboats, monster trucks, drones coming to the rescue, neighbor helping neighbor? Or is it going to take, even in Houston now, a stronger collective response, government response? Do we need a Green New Deal to deal with a new era? Rebecca Elliott joins us from the London School of Economics. She's been writing about this. Start with the environmental side of this. What are you suggesting would be? I mean, we think of New Deal, we think of FDR, and it was really in response to economic catastrophe in the Great Depression. But now the green part suggests awareness of what we're looking at in terms of the environment. What's a Green New Deal look like on that front, Rebecca?
Sure. Well, the two are inextricably linked, the economic and the environmental. And the Green New Deal, you know, we can think of solving environmental problems as a problem that can create jobs. So if we look to analogs in the New Deal itself, we could have a kind of reimagined Tennessee Valley Authority, which is about rebuilding our aging energy grid to better leverage the technological gains that we've already made in renewable energy and storage. We can move away from fossil fuels and put a lot of state support behind doing that. We could have something like a reimagined Works Progress Administration, where you have a core of people helping to retrofit building stock to make it more energy efficient, to build or rebuild infrastructure that's more resilient to extreme weather, that takes climate change into account. And then a big part of this, of course, is also investing in public education, something that we have been disinvesting from for the last several decades, so that we have the best possible science training engineers to help us confront the coming storms with the best expertise.
It sounds like a kind of renaissance of liberal politics, democratic politics from decades ago. Those have been largely in retreat for a long time. Is it the environment alone dictates this? How do you translate that into political readiness to adopt that kind of agenda?
I don't think it's the environment alone that needs to drive this conversation. I mean, I think there's a very strong economic case to be made. You know, the U.S. spent more than $350 billion over the past decade just responding to natural disasters, but FEMA budgeted only $90 million this year to prepare communities for those catastrophes. So we're already spending a lot of money. It's really a matter of how we spend it, of when we make those investments in order to avoid losses in the future. And FEMA itself estimates that every dollar spent on mitigation saves $4 on avoided losses. So I think the case can be made to, you know, even people who consider themselves more fiscally conservative, that this is just a smarter way to spend money because it's money that we're spending anyways. And the $180 billion dollars that they're estimating for Harvey and what this relief package might look like, that will probably go through, but you have people involved in those conversations in Congress suggesting that that needs to be offset by cuts to other social spending. And what that means is that you just have more vulnerable people as you further cut that social spending. So this is a way to sort of break that cycle.
What about those conservatives who would say, well, you can't just make an automatic logic chain between these greater challenges and the need for government intervention to address it or confront it? Look at all the motorboats that came out in Houston. That's individuals on their own initiative helping their neighbors. And there you go. That's the way.
Certainly. And you know, that's something that I think we should be very proud of as Americans. That's something we consistently see happen in the wake of any of these disasters. But the scale of the rebuilding and the kinds of rebuilding that we need, the different kinds of rebuilding that we need, I think exceed the capacities of any individual, any group of neighbors, any kind of family network. And we have the history that shows us we can meet these types of challenges. I think it's a matter of learning those lessons and applying them in the present moment.
A couple of callers, and I want to bring Bill McKenzie in from Dallas, Texas. But first, Fawn in Abington, Maryland. Fawn, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Rebecca Elliott. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom and Rebecca. I'm a coastal ecologist, and my question for Rebecca is, Irma's Category 5. We're looking at Florida. They have a climate change ban, Governor Scott, that occurred. You couldn't say it in state government. I've worked in coastal ecology up and down the East Coast. I'm an environmental educator. Have we reached, or will we reach, dire circumstances that would enable us to collectively as a nation come up with and agree we need a Green New Deal? I'm all for it, but this has been a very frustrating administration, to say the least, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better, despite the fact that we're facing, as 99% of the scientists know and have published and peer-reviewed, and I follow and track as part of my profession, climate change is real, and warming temperatures are fueling these extreme storms and extreme droughts, and that's my question. Thank
you. We got it from the front lines. Rebecca Elliott, how about it? Is Harvey dire enough to really get this conversation engaged, taking on traction, or not?
It's hard to say. I mean, my research on these topics started with Hurricane Sandy, and I thought for sure that once New York City, of all places, was underwater and the power was out, that this would start a meaningful national conversation about kind of reimagining our economy and the way we live our lives. You know, we started down that path, and in New York City, to a large extent, has gone very far down that path. But it is hard to say what the kind of lasting impression of Harvey will be. I'm cautiously optimistic insofar as I think that the media and politicians are getting a little bit nervier about relating disasters like this to climate change and setting an expectation that we can't continue to respond in this very reactive way. We can't continue to think of these as acts of God, but in fact, there's a lot more that we could be doing right now to make everyone safer and more secure in the future.
Of course, that gets around to which media are you talking about and which politicians.
Sure.
Daniela in New Orleans, where they know something about hurricanes. Daniela, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Paul. Tom, well, yeah, I worked in the post-Katrina reconstruction, and I've been in community development for over 15 years. I think the biggest issue that we have is the political economy of disasters. Politicians make decisions based on what's going to get them votes. And for example, they have no incentive for higher mitigation and preparedness spending because those are invisible investments. You don't see them until you need them. It's not the same thing as building a school or building a playground. The other problem is that we need to build a viable risk-sharing scheme to deal with disasters and with floods. For example, the flood insurance program is being subsidized. It's not mandatory. And that means that people don't have access to quick funds to rebuild. And also, they don't understand the real risk their properties are facing when the policies are subsidized.
But it's a political economy question, and there's no question about that. How these events are interpreted and what politicians do in advance or after, what people sense and demand. I appreciate your call, Daniela. Rebecca, stand by in London. Bill McKenzie joins us from Dallas, Texas. He's editorial director for the George W. Bush Institute at the George W. Bush Presidential Center Library. Pulitzer Prize-winning former editorial columnist at the Dallas Morning News. Bill McKenzie, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
I'm sorry to have to speak with you in the wake of all the destruction and woe from Harvey, but you see the point that Rebecca Elliott is making here, and it's been made before for some years now, people saying we need to reorganize our economy and maybe our safety nets to take into account what we're facing in an era of climate change. Now, here's Texas presenting Washington with a big tab for the recovery after all the damage, maybe $180 billion, the Texas governor is saying now. Is there a sense in your neck of the woods, Bill, that there may be some wider reorganization of our economy and our preparedness that needs to go on at the same time that we're thinking about recovery from what just hit us?
Well, not at this moment, no, because people are all focused on the immediate. You know, what I would say is I hope we don't turn episodes like this into kind of another red state, blue state battleground. Or kind of a politics of false choices between big government or small mediating institutions. And I think you said something at the outset, you know, trying to find the right balance. And that's kind of the way I see it. I mean, I think we have we've all watched the power of mediating institutions stepping in, churches, neighbor helping neighbor, the people on the boats that you're talking about going in. You know, government can't do that, and we shouldn't expect government to do that. This is really this is the power of local communities stepping in to deal with immediate problems. On the other hand, and Rebecca's pointed to some ways to think differently about how we do things like alternative energies. That's something that local communities can't do. That's the debate we need to have. You know, I would point out we do have alternative energies through natural gas, and there are a lot of people who on the left don't particularly like fracking. So, but that's unleashed a lot of natural gas and an alternative energy. So these debates don't really happen neatly. And I think we have to talk across the board about them. And I think important to do to think about, and I would say this for left, right, and center, what are the core functions of government? What does government need to do well? And let's focus on that. Is that building roads? Is that transportation in the aftermath of this? Is this somehow dealing, as Rebecca talked about, with figuring out better strategies for low-income housing, which is an issue that we faced here in Dallas, you know, absent Harvey. And yet, to complicate it just a little bit more, people like to diss Houston for having no zoning. Well, those no zoning no zoning attitude has allowed Houston to supply housing for lots of middle class families because the growth can continue to happen. The same thing here in Dallas or in North Texas where we do have zoning regulations, but there's ample room for developers to go out and build more housing. And yes, that creates a spread of suburbs. People don't necessarily want to, embrace suburbia or, the downsides of exurban growth. But that does supply middle-class housing and makes places affordable for the middle class.
You know, Bill, I mean, I take your point that we don't want to politicize this. On the other hand, I feel kind of allergic when I see politicians come out after a disaster like this and say, this is no time to talk about climate change or politically fraught subjects. I mean, in normal times, it's easy to have denial, and we see plenty of it. In emergency times, we may logically want to talk about what we're staring at and what it might mean. I mean, would you say at least that it's appropriate to think in systemic terms about how we are or are not ready for an era which may have, we're looking at bigger storms than we've ever seen lately?
Of course, it's appropriate to think systemically. I don't know exactly what that means. That's where the debate will come. Of course, we need to think about these things. That's just common sense to think ahead and prepare. But I don't think it's just as easy as saying we need to do X, Y, and Z, and if we just did this, then Houston would have been okay. Well, you know, again, let me point out the zoning, which is again, people like to criticize Houston for not having. That has made Houston a livable place for many families.
And then comes Harvey. Rebecca Elliott.
And then comes Harvey. Yeah.
Rebecca, what about examples from other countries that we might be considering right now so we don't just get lost in our own narrow American conversation here when it comes to readiness, when it comes to greenness in the face of climate change?
Sure. I mean, I think we can look to the Dutch, who are perhaps the global experts on how you live in very kind of precarious relationship to water. The Dutch have plunged major, very innovative investments into flood control and security, you know, going back to the formation of their first systems of dams and dikes. But now they're looking at more adaptive solutions, you might say, with this new kind of space for water approach. They're putting houses and office buildings kind of floating in the water. They've created sacrificable multi-use urban space that can retain water when necessary. And they're just much more kind of open to the idea of regional planning, not leaving so much on individuals to figure out how to manage and adapt to, but engaging in more collective planning and response. But I think, you know, we can also look to examples in our own country. If we're thinking about public investment and social provision as kind of key planks of a Green New Deal, then some of the most inspiring examples are actually coming from our own cities. So, for instance, in New York City just this summer, Mayor de Blasio launched an initiative to reduce harm from extreme heat. And that program specifically targets the disproportionate effects of extreme heat on New York City's most vulnerable residents, such as elderly people who live alone or poor people who can't afford air conditioning. So not only are they spending a lot of money to do things like plant trees in poorer parts of the city, but they're also providing climate risk training to home health aides. They're working on expanding the Home Energy Assistance Program, which assists low-income households. So we really have a lot to learn from what's going on in our own country.
Rebecca Elliott, please stand by there at the London School of Economics. Bill McKenzie at the George W. Bush Presidential Center. We're talking about the call for a Green New Deal from some quarters in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. With Harvey behind us, Irma ahead, and fires all over the West, we are talking about how to organize for the years ahead. Talk of a Green New Deal in some quarters, but everybody thinking about what is the way to brace for what is coming with climate change and more. You can join us this hour. Do we need a Green New Deal to deal with this? Are we going to have to rethink, reinforce our safety nets, our regional planning, our regulation of who builds where? Do you welcome more government here or fear it? And will fire and flood and storm force us to rethink the way we do things? How would you point that rethinking? Rebecca Elliott is with us from the London School of Economics. Bill McKenzie is here, Pulitzer Prize-winning former editorial columnist with the Dallas Morning News, now at the George W. Bush Presidential Center in Dallas at the library there. Lots of people thinking about what's going on here and the right posture, the right attitude of response. Here's FEMA agency officer Kevin Hannis telling ABC's Good Morning American yesterday that Texans affected by Harvey and its catastrophic flooding should not be seen as victims, but survivors.
First and foremost, they're not victims, they're survivors. Survivors are able to not only have us help them, but they're able to help their community. As you saw during the response, it was Texan helping Texan. In fact, we had folks from Louisiana, the Cajun Navy, coming over and helping during the response.
Texan helping Texan one by one, and the Cajun Navy coming over. We saw those motorboats on their trailers heading to rescue people. But this goes all the way up to the very biggest questions of federal, national spending and debt and all the rest. On Fox News host Chris Wallace on Sunday asked Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin about the possibility of tying Harvey relief to a vote on raising the whole country's debt limit.
The head of the House Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows, says he does not want to see that disaster aid tied to a bill to raise the debt limit. Can you guarantee him and others that that won't happen?
No, I can't. Quite the contrary. The president and I believe that it should be tied to the Harvey funding, that our first priority is to make sure that the state gets money. It is critical. And to do that, we need to make sure we raise the debt limit. So if Congress appropriates the money, but I don't have the ability to borrow more money and pay for it, we're not going to be able to get that money to the state.
Texan helping Texan is great, but it goes right up to the biggest fiscal issues in the country. People responding here on Facebook, Aviva says, sadly, the far right is too entrenched in their attacks on science and their fear of diminished profits. They will keep fighting until we all drown. They don't care. Michael says better civic planning could at least reduce the impact of these disasters. Buddy says, while I sympathize for the people affected by the flooding and storm damage, I don't wish to share their risk with them. Rebecca Elliott's talking about risk sharing, safety nets, and more. Bill McKenzie looking on from a Texas point of view at what this may actually mean. Jeffrey's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Jeffrey, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is, 200 countries went to Paris representing thousands of political parties, and there's only one major political party in the world that I'm aware of, the Republican Party, that denies the science of climate change. So how does one come up with sort of a Netherlands style of national, state, and local coordination if you have a major political party that sort of left a portion of its brain in the 18th century?
Rebecca, do you feel like we're handicapped in moving ahead by entrenched views of the world, science, climate change?
Certainly, it's a major obstacle. And, you know, ideas like the Green New Deal have been circulating for a long time, but ideas don't just kind of rise to their moment. Ideas have to be fought for. And I think that, you know, where to kind of place our hope in overcoming those obstacles is in a broad coalition that crosses multiple sectors of society, of people who recognize that climate change is not a niche environmental issue. It's what's at stake is the economic security, the very livelihoods and lives of American individuals and families.
Bill, do you worry about embedded financial interest resisting change, the kind of change we might need to have the resilience we need in this century for financial interest until, as our listener says on Facebook, you know, we're all drowned?
Well, I mean, of course, financial interest over time may resist change, but, you know, also history is replete with examples of things that change all of us and we move ahead. So let me give you an example. I've been thinking about this. That is perhaps somewhat an answer to what Rebecca is talking about. Here in Texas, we have a response to droughts. As you know, we've had a number of them,
yes.
Not right now. And so there's an ongoing water planning process that involves local communities. It involves the state. It involves regions. It was created under George Bush when he was governor with conservative Democrats supporting it. It was executed under Rick Perry as governor. It's still going under Greg Abbott as governor. And these regions come together and they identify what their long-term water needs are. And guess what? In North Texas, where we have not had a strong history of water conservation, we are now getting 25% of our water through water reuse and water conservation. Or I should say that is what we will be doing as we execute this plan. And that is what's happening. And Texans voted for a significant amount of money to fund this plan 4 years ago. And Republicans, led by Joe Strauss, our Speaker of the House, went out and campaigned for this to get support for to get investments in this long-term water plan so we can use things like water conservation as a way to combat drought in the future. We know we're going to have more droughts. Let's be ready. So here's an example of a collaborative process that involves business, it involves environmental groups. They're all required to be at the table. And you are seeing this kind of collaborative effort. It isn't just a government effort. It isn't just a local effort. It's a combined effort.
What about when it comes to what many people see as the core issue here, fossil fuels? I mean, there was this sort of terrible irony, obviously, in Houston of the biggest refineries of fossil fuels in the country being in the path of this deluge. When it comes to fossil fuels, how do you tap the brakes in a state like Texas or look beyond them?
Well, I think it's, again, this is I think it's kind of a false choice. We're not all of a sudden going to be weaned off of fossil fuels.
Well, we're told if we don't get off of dirty fossil fuels, that then these climate change effects will just become worse and the storms just become stronger and more destructive.
Yeah, but we're all going to go get in our car today in some way and drive someplace. So you're going to need the fossil fuels to supply that. I think this is more of a long-term strategy, which, again, I point out, look at the debate we've had over in states like New York and Pennsylvania over fracking. Here in Texas, you know, we've had the debate some, too. Even though they're large, huge parts of the economy here, there's still benefit from it. But that natural gas is an alternative fuel. Terrific. We're trying to do it. Well, where's all the support for it? Some people don't want to have it because they're fearful of the consequences of it. Well, some of this stuff just doesn't happen easily.
Yeah, long term. And then you look at Harvey and Irma maybe, and it looks like the future is right now. Dave in Port Huron, Michigan. Dave, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, hello. My question for your guest is I think I personally believe that the Democrats blew this in the last few elections by making or failing to make this a national security issue, which has traditionally been the Republicans and the conservatives' strong point in this country. I really feel that on a worldwide basis, there will be more conflicts as people fight over resources that will be jeopardized. So my question is to your guess is, do they feel that is a major concern that the Democrats should have brought up as far as a national security issue? Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Rebecca, I don't know if you follow the politics of this, but what about the way it's presented and whether the U.S. adequately understands this as a national security issue, whether that's part of the conversation here in a degree equivalent to what you see elsewhere around the world?
Certainly. I mean, the connections between security and climate change are being forged at the global level. You see conversations about this at multilateral meetings at the UN. It's something that I think could have more traction in American politics. You know, and not just as a national security issue. I mean, I think the more general principle, the more general opportunity, perhaps, is to mainstream climate change into all sorts of policy conversations that we think about as quite separate.
And there you have national security. Doug in Tampa, Florida. Doug, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. We have hurricanes here every year. We've got a season every single year, and we plan for hurricanes. I choose to live here in Tampa, and just like if you lived in the Midwest, you plan for tornadoes. And just as part of the normal preparation, I think this whole thing's overblown a little bit because of that.
What about the scale of the storms we're seeing, though, Doug? I mean, we're being told Irma now, which may, I hope not, but could, I suppose, even affect hit Tampa, is just pinning the needle. People saying, you know, professional storm watchers saying they've never seen a storm of this size. Does that not get your attention?
No, it doesn't, because, you know, we have storms that come through. It's not abnormal to have a storm come through at different variations. You look at Homestead, Florida, and it got wiped out. And, you know, those things were planned for ahead of time. These things just happen.
Bill McKenzie, is it still time for that attitude? No big deal. You know, the weather comes and goes. Sometimes it's bad and sometimes it's not. We don't need a special posture of readiness here.
Well, I do. Yes, the weather comes and goes. There's no question about that. I'm not enough of a scientist to know, you know, over a 50, 75-year period, what the frequency of the storms are like.
Well, that sounds like Rick Perry now, and just saying, okay, I'm not enough of a scientist. I mean, how many years of science do we have to have poured on our heads until we...
That's not where I'm going.
Okay.
Okay. I agree. Climate storms come and go. However, here's my point. You look at Galveston in the storm that hit there in 1900, which my great grandfather survived by going to the fourth floor of the tallest building in town. Later, after that, the region, the city came back and they raised the island. That required a lot of planning and effort. It was a smart move, and it saved Galveston along with building the seawall. So, you know, we can't have our heads stuck in the sand. I don't want to come across that way. I think we do have to have smart efforts to figure out how we cope with these things that are going on, which I mentioned about drought. I mean, that's another.
Got it. Brant in Oklahoma City. Brant, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. I was just wanting to put my two cents in on the new Green Deal, in that I think as a rich country as we are, we should make the investment in the technology of solar and wind. In Oklahoma, we're seeing wind become more and more powerful, but we see the right wing of the GOP attacking them, while we have oil and natural gas pay the lowest growth production tax of the whole region at like 2 or 3%. So we have this constant attack on energy that could save us. And we even have companies like, I'm sorry, but we have companies even fighting the climate science themselves by putting out falsified climate research. And we have technology. We have solar panels that can become roads. We have solar panels that can become windows of skyscrapers. We have solar panels that become roofs of housing. I don't see how we can't just make that investment to have a better future. But instead, we are... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Brant, what do you say to Doug in Tampa who says, look, there have always been storms. Don't get so excited.
I think he's got his hand in the Tampa sand. I mean, I live in Oklahoma where we have tornadoes, but a tornado is different than a hurricane. A hurricane terrifies me. I live through tornadoes like there's the afternoon tea. No big deal. You watch it. You see if it's coming towards you. If the tornado is, you take precautions. But a hurricane, like I believe Irma was said, it's over 150 miles in diameter, correct? It's huge. There's no way to avoid it. Right? And it's immeasurable. They haven't had something this large. Like you were telling him, when is the point of it's enough? It's too impactful to become deniable.
Brent, I appreciate your call. And let me get one more, if I may, from Florida, where they know something, all, of course, about storms. Anna is calling from Auburndale. Anna, you're on the air.
How are you?
Okay. What do you know, Anna?
Well, I wanted to mention that in 1989, I was a buyer for JCPenney in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I lived in a condominium right across the street from the International Airport. I lived Yugo in my apartment. And let me tell you, it was a Category 4, and it came with such viciousness that they don't understand, the people that are talking, and, oh, it's just a storm, I've decided to live in Tampa. Let me tell you something, when a mass this big is coming over an island that measures 100 by 35, you get on your knees and you ask God for forgiveness, because this is bad. And people are like, oh, I can get on a car and go. No one in Puerto Rico can get in a car and go. You know, so it's like it is tearing up these little islands and Puerto Rico and everything else that is going to go, and it will be coming towards us. You need to be serious about this. Climate change, it is for real.
Anna, I appreciate your call. Rebecca Elliott, I mean, here we are. It's not a new conversation, but we've got people's attention with storm coming right on top of storm. What would you imagine as steps toward the Green New Deal that you have in mind? Steps, next steps.
Well, it's a political question. I mean, I think that, you know, my grandmother lives in South Florida, and she's facing this storm. She's an older woman. She lives alone. You know, what I want for her, what I want for all Americans as an American, as someone who studies disasters and has studied the kind of aftermath of disasters, are conditions where it's not just about getting relief from the storm, it's about a substantive response. You know, what comes next that's going to allow us to live our lives differently in a way that prevents us from having to be flood victims or flood survivors in the future? And I think, you know, like I said earlier, the demand for that is going to have to come from a broad coalition of actors in society.
Yes, it's going to have to come from voters, and we'll see where they stand. I mean, some are in the path, some are watching from afar. Everybody with a stake in it, as Texas goes to the federal government for maybe $180 billion, the governor of Texas now says, for bailout from Hurricane Harvey, and Irma on its way. Rebecca Elliott at the London School of Economics. Your op-ed piece is up at our website, onpointradio.org. Listeners, check it out. Rebecca, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Bill McKenzie at the George W. Bush Presidential Center there in Dallas, Texas. It's always great to have you, Bill. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be with you.
Listeners, thanks for all your thoughts and comments. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.